I can see you better. Just to update you on things, today's kind of an experiment because this is the first time I've looked at things from this distance. And so a couple of things to make mention of here before we get underway. First of all, the wedding was a success in the sense that at the end of the day, they were married, so we got that done. And then the surgery went well. I have a new lens in my right eye, and it's a new experience. It's like seeing all over again. Colors are just incredible. I mean, it's like I didn't even realize how bad I didn't know how bad my left eye was until I got my right eye done. Now my left eye's all dingy. It's like, bleh, and this eye is like, wow. And my brain is like, well, I don't know what to do. So a couple of things. My right eye is still dilated. They are purposely dilating it for the next week or so. And in order to set for this lens to set properly, I have to wear reading glasses. So I got like a $5 pair of 1.5 reading glasses, and anything within arm's length, I have to have those on. So I am going to have them on while I'm teaching. But what they're trying to do is to get my far vision set, and then they said it's much easier to set the close-up vision. So with that right eye dilated, I see like halos around. I got the old grandpa sunglasses, you know. My dad had to wear those big, heavy sunglasses. I didn't wear them in here because I was too proud. They're out in the car, but I wear those in the sunlight because that eye is so dilated. And it's actually not nearly as bad as it was the last couple days. It was, when you get out of surgery, you can't even hardly see your iris. Your eye's so dilated. I didn't know my eye could be that dilated. But I don't remember a lot about the surgery. It was pretty painless. The staff that was there was really amazing. I do remember one thing. They take you in. You went to, did you have the laser do your eye? Okay, did you go to Blue Ridge Surgery? That's where I had it done, and they use that laser thing, and it makes the incision. And I remember it, the one thing I do remember really well was that they put me under this thing, and they've got this big contraption down at your eye, and they take some gigantic clamp and stretch your eye out, and you can't feel any of that, and it's like, I don't really care what you do to me. And but what was really great, it's kind of loud, it's got a noise to it, you know, and you're looking at these lights, and then all of a sudden your eye goes blank. I mean, you lose your, he tells you that you're going to be blind in that eye for a moment, but he said, we'll turn it back on. And there was a nurse who was standing right next to me, and the entire time I was in there, she was rubbing my shoulder, and she would just pat that my shoulder and rub my shoulder. And I can remember as they finished with that, they took me out of that room, and then I was going to go in and he's going to replace a lens. I grabbed that nurse and I said, ma'am, I said, I don't know if anybody tells you this or not, but you probably aren't told this very much, but that was very comforting. And I said, I just want you to know I really appreciate that. She goes, why, thank you. And I'm having this conversation with her with my eye cut open, and I was like, we need to get you in this other room now, sir. And so, okay. And I wasn't there to make friends, I guess. But anyway, so we'll see how all this goes today. There's no guarantee as far as you know how it's going to go, but I think everything should go very, very smoothly. We do have Bible class. Like I say, the really weird thing is that one eye's dingy and one eye's clear, and it's just going to be difficult until I get my left one done. But we do have our regular Bible classes this morning. We will have Wednesday Bible class and next Sunday, and that will be it for before our long break, our fall break, that will be for the about the last half of the month. We will be coming back, though, on the 30th, I believe. Is that right? Is the 30th a Sunday? I think we'll be coming back on the 30th. So what I want to do is, I'm pretty sure I'm going to be able to get all of this tied up and completely done with our instruction of judgment and the post-doctrinal exhortations, and have it completely done by next Sunday. Whether or not we take both classes next Sunday or not, I don't know. But what I want to do is, in fact, we'll have the Lord's table next Sunday, second session. Okay? Is that good? Is this getting printed? Next Sunday, second session. And then after that, after our Bible class on Sunday, let's have a meal together. Let's celebrate, have a party, and really enjoy the fact that we now have three of these decision-making skills under our belt. So if y'all want to bring food, especially food that I would enjoy, which is about anything y'all make, does that sound good to everybody? We'll kick off the fall break with a party. This thing should all be done by then. I'll make sure that we're done by then. So second session next Sunday, the Lord's table. Right up following the Lord's table, we'll have a good old-fashioned fellowship dinner on the grounds type thing. Any questions? Everybody's thinking, what do I bring? Somebody's going to come up with a sign-up sheet. You can't do something like this without a sign-up sheet. So there's got to be an official sign-up sheet in the back there somewhere. But we've never, ever under-planned these things. We always have plenty. So we'll just enjoy talking about what we've got under our belts. Any announcements that you'd like to make the assembly aware of before we get going? All right. All right. Well, let's see what we can do. Before we get ourselves started this morning, now please, would you turn in your Bibles to Proverbs chapter 4. Proverbs chapter 4. This is the post-doctrinal exhortation. Gosh, I want to do this now. This is the exhortation a son or daughter would receive once they have received the instruction of godly judgment. And I think what I'll do is, since we've had a little time between now and the last time we were together, let's pick this up at we're going to read the entire exhortation, post and pre and post doctrinal exhortation for judgment, that begins in verse 10. Verse 10, "Hear, O my son, and receive my sayings, and the years of thy life shall be many. I have taught thee in the way of wisdom. I have led thee in right paths. When thou goest, thy steps shall not be straitened, and when thou runnest, thou shalt not stumble. Take fast hold of instruction. Let her not go. Keep her, for she is thy life. Enter not into the path of the wicked, and go not in the way of evil men. Avoid it. Pass not by it. Turn from it, and pass away. For they sleep not, except they have done mischief, and their sleep is taken away, unless they cause some to fall. For they eat the bread of wickedness and drink the wine of violence. But the path of the just is as the shining light that shineth more and more unto the perfect day. The way of the wicked is as darkness. They know not at what they stumble. My son, attend to my words. Incline thine ear unto my sayings. Let them not depart from thine eyes. Keep them in the midst of thine heart. For they are life unto those that find them, and health to all their flesh." And what we're really after here is verses 23 through the end of the chapter especially. Keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. Put away from thee a froward mouth, and perverse lips put far from thee. Let thine eyes look right on, and let thine eyelids look straight before thee. Ponder the path of thy feet, and let all thy ways be established. Turn not to the right hand, nor to the left. Remove thy foot from evil. Before we get ourselves started today, Eric, I know you're back there. Would you please lead us in prayer? All right. Now, what I want to do this morning is focus our attention especially upon verses 23 through 27. And actually, in our last lesson together, we've basically come down to the point where all we've got left is the last verse, verse 27. But as you listen to this exhortation, and again, this is the one that, even though this was written to Israel, for and about Israel, and to those who will one day receive the adoption of sons as the remnant of Israel and function with the doctrine contained in this and all things pertaining to them, the format or the kind of skeletal system of what this is doing is still applicable to us in this dispensation of grace. This is the tone. These are the things that a father would say to a son and a daughter who have now completed receiving from him the instruction of godly judgment. They've got it down now, and the last thing the father wants to do is to set in his son's mind this final, it's almost like that brick wall that we talk about. There's a final bit of mortar that has to go over the top of that brick that sets that brick permanently in the son's heart, that ensures that these things have really been written on the fleshy tables of his heart. And then he's going to do something after this to ensure that that's taken place. That is, the son's going to do something to make sure that's taken place. But the father sets a tone here in the son's thinking about what he's received in these sayings that has given him the ability now to make godly judgments and discern between good and better and best, and to be able to make long-range plans without his father telling him every step to take and every single thing to do. That with that wisdom and that justice, and now with the sayings that come in the short packets of information within the godly judgment, he now can take that, and it functions as that catalyst, and he can now do some things that he could never do before. And of course, this is all leading him into a new aspect of his father's business that for us has to do with our father engaging the adversary in the father's contention with the adversary, and we get now to participate in that. And so there is a tone that this takes, and the father intentionally makes it serious. And it is serious. You listen to those words and you go down through this thing, and it's a very serious matter. And folks, this is something that if you think this is going to get easier, or if I'm going to relent and I'm going to let up as we go on, you're sadly mistaken. I'm going to push harder as we go on than I ever have before. And what I mean by that is, this is serious business. There really is a thing called the judgment seat of Christ. There really is. And we're gonna get to that in the next chapter of Romans. There's a reason why that's brought up in Romans 14. And there's going to be consequences at that judgment seat of Christ. You know from back in Romans chapter 8, you have the possibility, as you suffer with Christ today, to become not only an heir of God and have eternal life in the heavenly realm, but to be a joint heir with Jesus Christ and enjoy the benefits of governing and reigning and ruling. And the things that we've covered the last time we were together that kind of gave you a refreshment on the things that sonship education holds out for you. Well, there is reward and decoration at that judgment seat, and there's also seat. And we're beyond the point in this assembly. We're beyond the point of me standing up here, and I'm not berating anybody. I'm not going to do that anymore. But I'm going to be relentless in telling you, as an adult to an adult, as a father surrogate to a son, and as a father to a daughter, that this is a serious matter. This is going to have eternal consequences. This is going to matter when it comes to reward and decoration at the judgment seat of Christ. And one of the things that you are not going to be thinking about, involved with, or what's going to be a matter and a concern to you at the judgment seat of Christ is most of what your life is on this earth. In other words, whether or not you made it to certain ball practices, or whether or not there's going to be a real soberness that comes around where you're going to really see, and this is a time to say this because this has all been dealing with our time. And for this assembly to get past Romans 13, verse 14, for us to get past this chapter and still have some in this assembly who can't seem to realize that the priority of their time is their sonship education, that's shameful. That's a shameful thing. But it is not at all out of the ordinary. Not at all. But that's probably one of the dirtiest words that you could ever say to me. That, well, he's just an ordinary Christian. I don't want to be an ordinary Christian. Ordinary Christianity is a mess. That's why the Father takes the tone with the Son that he does here. You're now going to be engaged with an adversary. You've been having to live in the course of this world, and it's got its tugs and its pulls and its demands, and it has shaped you. You're all, including me, we are all damaged goods. We've all been shaped and molded by the course of this world. And now we're being conformed by the renewing of our mind and being transformed and conformed into the very image of Christ, in the image of God's Son. That should excite you more than anything else you do, more than anything else you have, more than anything else that you could possibly have. That should be the central excitement of your life. That's what I'm here for. Because this will be over in the blink of an eye. This time on this earth will be gone. And training will be over. School will be now dismissed. And then you're going to be placed as sons and placed as daughters. And it's going to matter what you did here. And for some of you, and maybe not you, even of you who are here today, but for some, it's going to matter more than they know now. And the Father takes a very serious tone with His Son here. And He knows what's at stake. He knows far more of what's at stake than His Son does now. And so we come down to this final exhortation that the Father wants ringing in His Son's ears as He now has this skill set that He's acquired from His Father. Keep thy heart with all diligence. We talked about that. For out of it are the issues of life. That issue of life comes up over and over again in this exhortation. And that's talking about functional life. There are issues of functional life that you've not yet walked in, that you've not experienced. There are paths of functional life you're yet to take. But out of this are those paths of functional life. And those issues of functional life upon top of functional life are going to occur because you now have the capacity and the ability to make some decisions just exactly like your Father makes. And the Son is exhorted to put away far from Him froward mouth. And that doesn't mean that the Son is speaking with a froward mouth and perverse lips. That means that you're now going to be on the receiving end of this. This is the tactics of the adversary's policy of evil that's going to attempt to separate you from the love of Christ, that's going to attempt to subvert your godly thinking and overturn that godly thinking, and you're going to be on the receiving end of some froward mouths and perverse lips. And he says, put that far from thee. Let thine eyes look right on. Let thine eyelids look straight before thee. We're going to talk about that even more in a moment. And then he talks about pondering the path of thy feet, and let all thy ways be established. And we talked about that last time as well, and I'm not going to get into a review of all of that. It's all available. But this is the extreme intensified warning of there's danger out there. There's problems out there. You're not in any way to feel like that you're safe and sound as far as your your inability to be tempted, and that you're not able to be persuaded or have your thinking undermined. You are very persuadable, and so we have to make sure that thing sticks and that it is put there in a permanent situation. All right. One of the things we talked about last time before we move on to this last verse, in this extremely intensified warning, a son is now having freshly received his instruction of godly judgment. He needs to hear this from his father about this intense impending danger. You know, as a son and a daughter, what the subversive activity and methodology of the adversary is all about, what these evil men are going to do, the froward mouth, the perverse lips are going to vex you, and their success, listen, can be measured, as I said, in very small amounts. All the success that the adversary can have right now in his policy of evil can be measured by simply getting you to just begin to rethink your position. Just begin to rethink those works of darkness. And you eventually come to a point when in your mind a genuine opportunity exists, if those evil men have been successful in their policy of evil to get you to reconsider your stand. The issue is you eventually come to a point where the opportunity, a genuine opportunity exists, that in your mind, even rethinking it is a viable option. Even reconsidering it is a viable option. That's a victory to the adversary. Because you're supposed to come out of this with a stone, cold, firmly set mind that there is no way you're ever going to budge or move or reconsider those works of darkness. So even if you can get a person to the point where it's a viable option, I'm not reconsidering it, but I could. That's a victory. That's good enough. It's feasible for me to leave my path. I could see me doing that. It's possible. It's a workable. It's workable. I get off, I get back on. Off, on. I'll get off when it suits me, I'll get on when it suits me. And with that kind of strong, intense, passionate, fervid exhortation of verses 23, 24, 25, and 26, with all the power and might that a father can muster, and having that ringing in his son's ears, the father is now ready to say, and the son is now ready to hear the father's final words of the exhortation in this chapter. In verse 27, he says, turn not to the right hand nor to the left. Remove thy foot from evil. All right. Now notice, cast your eye back up to verse 26. Ponder the path of thy feet. Let all thy ways be established. We've been talking about paths and ways, right? And you've got the issue of the path and the ways being brought up here in verse 26. Now notice you have ways plural. Ways plural is commonly thought of as ways. When you talk about ways, oftentimes it gets encrusted in your mind that it's talking about just one thing. And especially when it's in the plural, the thought is that it's kind of a road that you travel. It's the path, the ways is kind of the road that you're on. And that's not really, in fact, many times that's not the way the word ways is being used. It's context sensitive, and sometimes it is. But I'm persuaded it's not here. Ways plural can also mean one's conduct and behavior, even one's labor, that is, one's manner of doing a thing, the ways in which you get something done, the ways in which you get things accomplished. And my understanding, that's what ways means here. When he says in verse 26, ponder the path of thy feet and let all thy ways, the ways in which you get these things accomplished, be established. And that is said in view of a son understanding and appreciating there is already in his mind there is something already set in your mind that's an overall type issue. It was already put there in your mind by your father back when the father set the son's measure of commitment to his sonship learning. And that's back in chapter 2 and 3. And that level of commitment is what is going to guarantee the son's success. That's what guarantees your success in your sonship education and getting everything out of it that God has built into it. That level of commitment. And when a son first hears from the father, the exhortation in connection with the first components of his education, which provides for his basic decision-making skills so that the fundamental paths can be chosen and a fundamental way can be established that provides for the son to get off on the right foot and to have that path that's going to guarantee as long as he stays on it, he's going to go all the way to the end and get to the ultimate objective. Notice, come back with me to what the father said back there. Come back to chapter 2, verse 6. Chapter 2, verse 6. If you let your eyes scan down through those first five verses, you remember those. Okay, we're going to be back here because this is where the son's commitment level is set. Well, we're not going to be back here. We're going to be at chapter 3. But that's where the son's commitment level is set. Pick it up at verse 6 after those first five verses. He says, "For the Lord giveth wisdom. Out of his mouth cometh knowledge and understanding. He layeth up sound wisdom for the righteous. He is a buckler to them that walk uprightly. He keepeth the paths of judgment and preserveth the way of his saints. Then shalt thou understand righteousness and judgment and equity, yea, every good path." And what I'm after in all of this, you'll remember we went over this once when and there's five particular issues there that actually match up with those five probing questions. But what I'm after is just to remind yourself of verse 8. He keepeth the paths, plural, of judgment. The paths, plural, of judgment. This is where he first sets this in his son's mind and preserveth the way, singular, way of his saints. And that's not that's talking about a road that he's on. All right? It's kind of like this. And this is in keeping now with the father's exhortation here over in chapter 4. If you come back there, that last verse when he says, "Turn not to the right hand nor to the left." That's built upon that exhortation that you got back in chapter 2. Especially when the son had set in his mind that he's going to keep the paths of judgment. There's going to be many of those, plural, and preserveth the way of his saints. And a son with his, we'll put his, put your eyes up here since we're talking about eyes. These are the eyes, if you're looking with the eyes of your understanding now, and you're standing here and you're looking, you've now got wisdom, justice, judgment down, you're now being exhorted by your father, and you're kind of looking down the overall way in which you're going, your sonship life. And you come along and you look and there's this ultimate out here at the end of the entire thing, going through this education. It doesn't matter who you are, son or daughter wise, coming into the education, when you get to the end of it, you are predestined. And that doesn't mean that's not Calvinistic predestination. That's what if you go to doctor's school You may, there's all kinds of people come in the front door, and when they go out the back door, they're all doctors. That school is predestined to make you a doctor, if you, in whatever field you want to go into. When I went to music school, we all came in one end. We all come out as high school band teachers. That's what we were all going in for. When you go into this instruction, there is a goal, an ultimate objective. And what were you told the ultimate objective was? I've mentioned it several times today. There you go. You're going to be conformed to the image of God's Son. And so, for us, that's what the ultimate objective is conformity to the image of God's Son. And there is a way, there is a singular way that is going, that we're going to stay on, that'll get us to that ultimate objective. And along the way, there are all these points of attainment. There's the entire curriculum with all of its aims, goals, and objectives, and its points where you can check and measure yourself, and all of those points of attainment are on the way. And in connection with the details of one's life, really for every one of us as sons and daughters, the way, singular way of every son is the same. Now the details are different. The details of a son's life are very dependent upon the life you live. They're dependent upon where you live. Some people who are, some saints who have done this before us face different challenges because they didn't live where we live. And it also has to do, it depends upon under what conditions you live, where you live, at what time you live. And what I'm saying is that makes it so that the paths of a son's life can be somewhat different. And that's why when you're talking about the overall objective and the way the Father first set this in an overall way in his son's mind was that a son understands with his eyes of understanding there's one way and there are many paths that are right and righteous. But there's multiple paths that make up his way. But the issue is that all of those paths are working on that one way. All those paths are getting you to the objective. That's why in Proverbs 2:8 he says, "He keepeth the paths, plural, of judgment, and preserveth the way, singular, of his saints." And there's many paths on this singular way because there are various operations of God that you are going to participate in. Various things that you're going to encounter. And there has to be, that has to be that way. In order for a book to be written 2,000 years ago, completed 2,000 years ago, and to be relevant at any time a son picks it up along the way. And again, these paths, the many paths, are going to be righteous, just, holy, godly paths. But they, for some of us here, for saints who lived in the 16th century in England, they had some different paths they took than what we'll take. But for now, after completing his instruction of judgment, a son looks out at that general way, and he sees that within that way are these various paths that he can choose. And they're upright paths. They're paths of uprightness, righteousness, godliness. That he's going to have to be able to make some judgments. He's going to have to be able to judge those paths to take that are the greatest supporting mechanisms of him keeping on that way. And that's something that you have to do. That's something that is integral in a body, by the way, and within a local assembly. It's one of the reasons why we have a board of deacons who, if you were to sit in on our meetings, we do not spend one second of our board meetings talking about what color chairs we have, or what color should we paint the building, or should we get a choir, or you know, who's making the cookies for the next cookie brigade or drive or whatever. Everything we do in this assembly is based upon you and I being edified unto godliness, which is in faith. That's what we do. That's why we're here. That's why I'm here. And when you make, you're going to have to make judgments about the details of your life, that you're going to take certain paths that are going to be the most supportive and most successful means for you to be keeping on your way. Because as a son, you realize, even though we're getting to the end of chapter 13 and it's yoo-hoo, yay, we celebrate and everything, we haven't even begun. We've just barely begun our education as sons together. This assembly has barely begun its existence to really function with functional life as an assembly. We're just getting started. It's one of the reasons why the younger people in this assembly are going to have to make some really big judgments and determinations. My hope is that this goes on another generation and then another until the rapture takes place. But there's no guarantee. It'd be a sad thing if it ended with me. That would be sad. That'd be pathetic. You got to do better than me. So you're going to have to determine paths that are going to be able to support you in making the progress to keep going to that ultimate objective. But then he's going to see something else with the eyes of his understanding. He's going to see there's an alternative way. It's alternative to that way. He's going to see that there's alternative ways that are going to be presented to him. And these alternative ways are not supplied by God. They're having nothing to do with his sonship education, except for maybe the one caveat that his sonship education warned him about these ways and warned him not to get off that way and remove his foot from this one. But that's the temptation. And again, this isn't we're not talking about tempting you to turn your back on church and to just blow off. And it can happen here. It can happen here. You can come here as a casual Christian, as an ordinary Christian. I don't know why in the world you'd want to, but, you know, it's kind of like taste. You know, there's no accounting for taste. Some people just, you know, they figure a little misery with Mark a week, that maybe is helpful. But to be honest with you, that's what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get you to see that this is going to, the subtleties that we're going to be confronted with are far beyond what we've ever discussed so far. And the idea is to recognize, for the Father to say something to the Son so that he's going to recognize that in connection with the policy of evil, there is an alternative way. And on that alternative way, there's also many paths to take. This is a counterfeit to that. And this doesn't have to be a way that leads to some kind of religion that would have you eating children's livers. No, this is going to reflect that very closely. Very closely. And the son's going to realize that there's not just one possible alternative way. There's another one. And it also has many paths on it. Or to put it the way God puts it here, there's an alternative way on the right hand, and there is an alternative way on the left hand. Now, what do you think, well, for one thing, you would say, well, the answer to this question would be because you only have two hands. But why does God put it that way? Right hand and left hand. You notice he puts it before the sun here, there's two alternative ways. What do you think that is? I don't know as if they're opposites. What? Yeah. How many major forms of opposition are you going to get from the adversary? Two. Evil men, strange woman. What are the two? What do you have corrective doctrine-wise following the book of Romans? What have you got? How many groups of people have you got? Two. Who are they? The Corinthians and the Galatians. Right here, the son is learning. And by the way, did the Corinthians think they were on that way? They didn't think they were on that way? I'm pointing to the middle one. There. Did the Corinthians think they were here? Yeah. I can't believe how red that line looks right now. Did the Galatians believe they were there? Yeah. 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 Every church is going to believe they're there. So the issue right now is for the son who has received the initial instruction of judgment and has engaged in this battle with the father in his contention with the adversary and his policy of evil, those two alternative ways, those are going to start tempting him. He's going to be tempted to turn. He's going to be tempted to an alternate way that's going to entice him, is going to allure him, and give him the opportunity, therefore, to depart from his father's way. It's not that he's going to become, in his mind, he's religious now, and he's not going to become religious anymore. It's not that. These are not atheistic ways. These are alternative ways of godliness. And if it's an alternative to godliness, it can only be called one thing, Satanliness. But the idea is, you have another father who is vying for your attention and for your education. And it's the adversary, Satan himself. He wants to be your father. Be your Lord, your bread giver, bread provider. And the son is going to be tempted to depart from his father's way and from the righteous paths that constitute it and either turn to the right hand or to the left hand, which means that the design behind the froward mouth and the perverse lips is to slowly erode your resolve to stay on that way and on those paths. To slowly erode your resolve and get you to rethink when it comes to those works of darkness, just begin to reconsider that stand that you've taken and to begin to dim that light and to begin to conform to what sounds to be so good and for the pressure of public opinion to come down upon you and to begin to shake you from that stand because you're too close-minded. You've got to be more open-minded and more tolerant and not so intolerant. And all of these words and all of these forces of culture and of opinion are going to begin to try to erode your resolve that you were taught by your father in Romans 13. And the goal of that policy of evil is to get to get you. It can't come along and kick you off that way and put a rope around you or a chain around you and drag you off of it. It can't do that. It's got to operate according to the power of God's grace. It's got to operate according to what grace has now done in you as a believer in Jesus Christ, what it's done to the power of sin in your body, what it's done to the whole issue of your body being a body of sin. It's no longer that. Sin still resides in it. Sin is still in your members, but it is not enslaving you anymore. So the issue, and the adversary knows that. And so the issue is to get a hold of that great ally that he still has with the sin in your members that we've looked at so many times, called lust. To begin to make its appeal and begin to chip away at that thing and to begin to get you to decide. You're going to have to decide to turn. That's why he comes. It says, don't be turned to the right hand nor to the left. It doesn't say that. It says, turn not. You're going to turn. And be very clear, the way that's written and the stylistic way it's put in the English in your King James Bible, turn not to the right hand nor to the left, remove thy foot from evil. The onus is all on the Son. It's not on the fact that somebody's come along and forcing you to do something. You're going to do this of your own free will volition. And you're always going to be vulnerable to that. And the great coup, the great feather in the adversary's hat, is once again to get you to make the decision to turn yourself either to the right hand or to the left. Which is why verse 25 told you, let thine eyes look right on. Let thine eyelids look straight before thee. Ponder the path of thy feet, which is what that godly, that whole body of instruction of godly judgment provides for. And the properly educated son at this point can discern. He has the discernment to be able to discern these very things. You're not on this way helpless. You now have some capacity. You've got some strength. You've got some ability now. And the adversary knows that. But he also knows where your soft underbelly is. He knows where his ally is in you. And he knows how powerful it is. And that's why these exhortations are so important. Just as important as the doctrine itself. Hence, once again, verse 27, turn not to the right hand nor to the left. Remove thy foot from evil. And there are some real subtle tactics that the adversary has at his disposal to get you to do this. I've tried to make you aware of some of them. Some things that we've talked about the way in which, and it's one of those things that kind of dawns on you and it gets developed over a period of time, but you begin to understand that it's one of the reasons why, hopefully woven into everything we've learned over the past months or years or whatever it's been, since we've been in, especially in verses 11 through 14, that you've become more aware, and I hope you think about it more, of this whole issue of the spirit which is of God and the spirit of the world, and this small case S spirit that I keep bringing up. And you know me well enough to know that I'll say, when something's really important, and oftentimes it's important because it's fresh in my mind, and since it's fresh in my mind, it's usually not very well thought out. So I will say it and say it and say it in different ways, and somewhere along the line I'll say it right. I don't think I've said it right yet, but somewhere I will. But there's, because this is still working in me, to begin to see the reality of how influenced by spirits I can be, and not become some apostolic woo, you know, that the idea that a spirit is some kind of supernatural goblin that jumps into my body kind of thing, it needs to be cast out, and that kind of business, but to really see that. That whole thing, at its core, there's some truth to that. It's just gotten so messed up with improper handling of God's Word and wrongly dividing the Word of truth that we tend to just take it and chunk the whole thing aside. But you are more easily manipulated than maybe you realize. And I hope some of the things we've said about that has made you think about how that I can be controlled by powers that aren't like people right near me. That's why I talk about the culture having its own power to persuade and to do things. You change hairstyles, you change entire lines of furniture in your house, you change dress, not based upon really anything. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm saying that it's a way to show you that you can be manipulated. Look at sports. I mean, people do things at sporting events that they would never do anywhere else. I've seen little old ladies at basketball games when I was in Indiana just rip a referee up one side and down the other, and she was one of the sweetest little ladies outside that basketball arena. But you get her. My mom was a little bit like that. She would sit there and watch basketball, and she'd just call the referees dopes. That was her swearing. Oh, you dummy. She didn't act like that any other time. Anyway, I don't want to get on down that line, but what I'm trying to say is there are some real, and that's just tiddlywinks, subtle tactics the adversary has at his disposal to get you to turn. To turn to the right hand or to the left. In fact, the truth be told, we haven't even begun to get an awareness of the real cleverness and craftiness of this adversary you and I are dealing with. Because there are degrees of cleverness and there are degrees of craftiness that even get you to think, like I said, that when you are out there, when you're actually out there on this right-hand alternative way or this left-hand alternative way, he has degrees of cleverness and craftiness to get you think when you're out there that you're actually still here. You're still there. But in reality, you're to the left hand or to the right hand. That's how good he is. You still think you're on your way. You still think you're being conformed to the image of Christ. That's kind of what Katie brought up. There are Christians who really would think that they're being conformed to the image of Christ today because they genuflected or they did something and or they darkened the door of the church or kicked in some or whatever it is, and they're not even on that way at all. So you can be so deceived that you won't even know it. That's how clever this guy is. Well, the bottom line is, you cannot even afford to let evil men begin to chip away at your resolve, because if you let them even begin, in a sense, they've got you. Like I said, if you just begin to realize that, you know, an alternative path is feasible. Now, that's not to say that there's no hope that you can't recover. You can. You and I both know that we have ways and means of recovery that are given to us in Romans chapter 8. In those five probing questions, we have an advocate. We have all of those measures of recovery that we have available to us of stop minding the things of the flesh and start minding the things of the Spirit and getting back on track. I'm not saying that there's no recovery, because there is. But you need your Father to have it put to you in that way, so that the impact of those evil men in that adversary's policy of evil and their cleverness and their craftiness and their subtlety that there is to their subversive activities makes a deep, listen, and permanent impression upon you. And that can happen. My father, for instance, made a very deep impression upon me when it came to the issue of snakes. As a six-year-old boy, he was, I've told you before, he was bit by a rattlesnake when he was in South Dakota. It's playing with his dog with a ball, and the ball went over the, he was at a creek, and it went over a little cliff by the creek, and my dad laid down to try to reach the ball. And right under that rock was a rattlesnake. The creek's noise was so loud he couldn't hear the snake's rattle. And his dog, which was a little collie dog, that dog knew that snake was there, and it was trying to, it almost tore my dad's pants off, trying to pull him back, but my dad was after that ball, and the snake got him right here. Full envenomation. And so my dad brought us up, always telling us a story about when he got bit by a rattlesnake, and he nearly died. He had to go to the hospital. There's a lot of weird things that went on back then. That was in 19, he was about 6 years old, so 17, 18, 19, 20, 22. That was 1923. But he survived that bite. And there was something about him telling us that story of firsthand experience, not of some snake handler in a zoo, but of my own father telling me about that experience, that it made a permanently deep impact upon me. I hate snakes. To this day, I can't stand them. And they frighten me. And I will not mess with them. I know what they can do, and I don't want any part of them. I don't need to have some naturalist come along and say, oh, aren't they beautiful? They may be beautiful to you, but they're not beautiful to me. He did the same thing in railroading. I'll tell you who's one of the safest people around a railroad crossing in this country. Me. Do you know what the most dangerous railroad crossing there is? It's one in the country where there's no signals. It's just the sign, and you can see for miles in each direction. It's the most dangerous crossing you can go across. You know why? Because that crossing is one that makes you not even look. You won't even look. And I've learned that. I learned that you don't throw things at a train because, well, now there's no caboose, but there used to be a caboose. My dad almost lost his vision because some idiot kid decided he was going to chunk ears of corn at the caboose as it went by, and it shattered his window and all the glass went in his eyes. Those are things that make deep, lasting, permanent impressions. Those are just natural things, let alone the serious nature of this. The Father has to put it to you this way so that something makes a deep and permanent impression. You get off of that way, you're dead. It's dangerous. You're going to functionally die. Out of that way, out of those paths, are the issues of life. These lead to death, functional death. Read a little later on here about that strange woman. Her end is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps take hold on hell. And the sinisterness of it and the subtlety of it is that you can think you're on your merry way to being conformed to the image of Christ. By the way, now you ought to start realizing why Paul said to the Galatians when he talked to them that there's a possibility of you worshiping another Christ, another Jesus. Anyway, you need to have it put that way so that impact of all that cleverness and craftiness and subtlety that you realize you're no match for this guy as far as what he can do. Stay away from him. That's why we told you last time, one of the best things you can do is flee. That's why Paul repeatedly uses the word flee idolatry. Flee fornication. And he told Timothy, flee these things. That's the need for this kind of exhortation. And that's why God has to have the Apostle Paul come along and say, as he does to us in Romans 13, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envying, but put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof. I would say that matches the tone of that exhortation very well. If there were only a remote chance for you to fulfill those lusts, In fact, come back to Romans 13 and look at it. Romans 13, 13 and 14. And when he says, "But put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof." If there was only a remote chance that you would fulfill those lusts, then he wouldn't have any need for this warning type, this admonition type of an exhortation. And if you need proof of that, just look. I'm not sure. I'm not putting them up here as if it's one or the other. But if you've got the Corinthians, you've got the Galatians, all you need to do for proof, further proof, look at the Corinthians. Just read in the next book after Romans. And you'll find out that the majority of the assemblies in Corinth began to walk honestly as in the day, and as soon as they did, they got victimized by the policy of evil, and they dimmed their light. They didn't stop going to church. They didn't stop having church. Some of them completely put their light out. They were on the receiving end. And by the way, the Corinthians and the Galatians did that when they were on the receiving end of far better and far more thorough, far more insightful, far more understanding teaching of these things than you've received. Because you're getting this from me. They got this from the Apostle Paul himself and from Apollos. The Corinthians especially. So don't think for one moment it can't happen to you, because it can. And with that ringing in your ears, I'm done. That's the end of the post-doctrinal exhortation. And that brings us then to our break for today. And when we come back, we will start the very last thing that we have to do with every component and form of doctrine that we deal with, and we'll deal with that right after our break. But that's the end of the doctrine, the end of the exhortation. So take your break. We'll come back in about 15 minutes.